This is not a tag team matchup, though. This is singles competition.
Drag Shawn Michaels. There's Shawn. He'll be facing the Hitman Bret Hart in our feature matchup this week on the Wrestling Challenge.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Wrestling Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 146 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, I'm going to be going back to the year 1990 for a look at WWF Wrestling Challenge from February 11th of that year, a rather infamous date in sports history, and I guess you could say sports entertainment history, because something that happened on that day would change the course of the WWF ever so slightly. I'll get to that in a moment, but let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown at gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed and listen to the other great shows on Pro Wrestling Only, such as Days of Thunder, looking at the WCW Thunder show from 1998 is where they are now, the Bigfoot Pro Wrestling Podcast, looking at independent pro wrestling from the Pacific Northwest. And, of course, my main dudes... It's kind of weird. Worldcast last week, not the one that came out a couple days ago, but last week they did the episode with the Sunshine face turn, and it was one of the greatest segments that they have ever done. And I'm going to include Titans of Wrestling in that. So go back and listen to, I think it was Worldcast number 81. It's one of the greatest episodes of podcasts of all time. So just do that for me. And while you're doing that, give Pro Wrestling Feed a 5-star review on iTunes. That would be greatly appreciated. Now, I just want to return to something from last week, because I have to close the book on this. I was talking about this snowstorm that happened up here last week with 17 inches of snow in my town on Monday, and then 5 inches of snow on Tuesday, and my snowblower breaking 4 minutes into the Monday snow removal and cleanup, which meant I had to move stuff, you know, by shovel, and with my driveway, it's rather difficult. But I got through it fine enough. On Friday night, I come home and I start basically trying to widen the bottom of the driveway, because with it being on a hill, everything kind of, you know, drips down, and we get kind of an ice patch at the bottom, which kind of sucks. I don't like to waste too much salt on that, because I'd rather have it for the hill. But long story short, on Friday, my wife gets home and says, instead of having, you know, breakfast for dinner, we're going to have eggs and something else. Would you like to get a pizza? And I said, yes. And little did I know how much I would regret that decision, considering the fact that, well, all right, I ate 4 slices of pizza, and it had Italian sausage and green peppers on it. And if you'll recall, if you're paying careful attention to what I'm saying on this show, I had gone off on this thing at the beginning of the show 2 or 3 weeks ago about being more careful about what I eat. You know, not going on a specific diet, but actually putting some thought into it. And eating 4 slices of that in one sitting is not putting a lot of thought into it. Because smash cut to the next day, 5 a.m., I am up with a terrible case of heartburn, which I've now figured out is what drove me to the emergency room just over a year ago. I think it was episode 82 that I ran through that piece of business. It might have been the Best of Show, Best of the Heel Turns, Volume 2. I can't remember, but I kind of went over that whole thing. So now I'm starting to figure out that if I don't eat right, I'm going to have a case of acid reflux and heartburn or whatever. I'm learning all about it right now. So I've started a course of Nexium, with this show dropping on Thursday. It'll be day 5 of my 14-day round. And so far, so good. As I tape this, did have a little bit of chicken soup go down wrong, and I've eaten more saltines than I'd care to admit over the last couple of days, but here's how bad it was. I mean, I almost wanted to go to the emergency room again or to an urgent care center because I just felt terrible to the point where I did go to the Boston Bruins Colorado Avalanche game last Saturday, and I don't leave these games early. The last time I ever left a game early was I think it was a Bruins Rangers game where the score was 3-0, and I wanted to get my train because otherwise I'd have to wait an hour and 10 minutes for the next one, and that's fine. This one I left during the second intermission because I could barely stand up because I had been up since 5 a.m. Now when I got up at 5, I watched this episode of Challenge and took a bunch of notes for it. So that's kind of what helped me get through the morning. Smash cut to Sunday. I'm running 2 miles around Krista McAuliffe Elementary School in Lowell, and I'm feeling a lot better. So shout out to the makers of Nexium. I know that stuff doesn't kick in that fast, but I'm only going to presume that I'm still going to be feeling all right in a few days. Maybe someday I can resume eating pizza and perhaps even having a beer now and then. It did remind me of one thing, which is when you do feel great and you do feel like you're in good health, go ahead and appreciate it because it ain't always going to be like that. I had mentioned that the day of this wrestling challenge, February 11th, 1990, is kind of an infamous day in sports history, and it would affect the WWF in a certain way. And while it was not a 5-star match by any means, it did take place in the Tokyo Dome.
A desperate one-eyed fighter. Brawling willingly just to try to get in the shot that will finish things in.
Oh, the uppercut.
What an uppercut by Douglas, and down goes Tyson.
It's over.
It's over.
Mike Tyson has been knocked out.
Unbelievable.
I can't really put it into words for anybody who's not old enough to remember just how big of a shock that was when Mike Tyson lost to Buster Douglas. I think he was something like a 39-1 favorite going into the bout. I mean, it was basically supposed to be just a tune-up for a future bout between Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield, which, as we've learned, Holyfield probably would have won that. A lot of stuff going on in Tyson's life anyway. But because Tyson loses that match, you got 12 days later, the main event in Detroit, Mike Tyson was supposed to be the referee, or advertised to be the referee for the Macho King Randy Savage challenging Hulk Hogan for the WWF title. Buster Douglas steps in, referees on the main event, which I talked about on the Place to Be podcast earlier this week. Do check that out on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. Suffice to say, I feel like James Buster Douglas, as they are very careful to say, because Buster is a derogatory term. I have heard the song Scrub, No Scrubs by TLC. I know what that's all about. It just didn't cut it from a star power perspective, especially since I don't think Douglas really watched wrestling growing up in the way Tyson would get into it when WrestleMania 14 would roll around. But anyway, back to this edition of Wrestling Challenge. The taping schedule around the Royal Rumble was actually fairly orderly, where the Rumble takes place on Sunday, January 21st in Orlando. The next day, on the 22nd, 3 episodes of Superstars were taped in Miami, Florida, and then back over to Fort Myers on my beloved Gulf Coast of Florida for the Wrestling Challenge taping the next day on the 23rd. A dark match on this show that is of some note to me. It's kind of interesting anyway. Paul Roma defeated Scott Hall, and this would have been Scott Hall's first match in the WWF, a tryout that I guess didn't really go anywhere. There's also a Macho King Randy Savage Ultimate Warrior match that was a dark match on this challenge taping that ended up on the unreleased 1986 to 1995 DVD. The beauty of this episode, other than the fact that it's in the February sweeps, and if you've noticed that these WWF shows have been hitting February and November very, very hard because, you know, you're building to Mania for one of them, you're building to Survivor Series for the other one, but, you know, the sweeps, you're going to put all your best matches in there. But there's a lot to talk about here, such as a honky tonk man and a still blonde Greg the Hammer Valentine. Yeah, them becoming a tag team called Rhythm and Blues, which they are called as such on this program. But it's their opponents that catch my attention. They're facing the Mulkeys, NWA, Techwood Studio, mainstays. Just kind of interesting. Got the Earthquake facing off against one of the old ding-dongs from the NWA. Apparently, there's some sort of refugee camp going on WWF. Earthquake had just dropped the Canadian from his name. More on that a little bit later. But this show features the very first one-on-one confrontation between Bret the Hitman Hart and Shawn Michaels. I wonder if that rivalry would ever lead anywhere as the decade would roll along. Just funny to think about how in one of the first six or seven episodes of the B Show in the 1990s, you get the rivalry that would, I guess, come to define the WWF by the time you get to the middle of the decade. Of course, they're both very much in a tag team at this point. So babyface versus babyface match, kind of an interesting thing. You think something might happen? Well, we shall see. But also, as a little bonus, as this took place on Superstars the week before, we get a look back at the Ted DiBiase versus Jake the Snake Roberts match, which featured an appearance from the Big Boss Man doing Ted DiBiase's bidding. Or at least he did until he changed his mind, which I'm going to get into and all the ramifications of that a little bit later on. So, as I said, there's a lot here to talk about, so why don't I just get right to it.
This week from the Lee Civic Center in Fort Myers, Florida, it's WWF Wrestling Challenge. Hi, everyone. I'm Tony Schiavone along with Gorilla Monsoon.
What a week this is going to be for Wrestling Challenge. We're Tony. We're going to announce the main event for WrestleMania 6, Sky Dome Main Event.
Sky Dome Main Event, we're set to go with action. Here we go.
I'm kind of disappointed that Tony Schiavone did not tell us about all the things going on in and around Fort Myers, because at this point, they were doing that on Wrestling Challenge, as well as Vince doing it on Superstars. 1990 is really about the time that they phased that out. I've been posting those on Twitter over the last month and a half. I need to get back to that, but you know, just kind of have to find them as I see them on YouTube. But I don't know what to really tell you about Fort Myers from 1990, although they drew a good crowd for this taping, a sellout crowd of 5,000. Actually, Fort Myers has two airports. You'd never know it because there's virtually no commercial service into the other one. RSW is the abbreviation for the big airport, but one time my mother went down to Fort Myers on vacation. She was actually going to Mako Island, great place to go if you're a Bostonian. And the airline that she flew into the little airport with went out of business while she was there. And I happened to be down at Fort Myers at the time, so I was meeting her for dinner. I called her up and I said, Ma, I don't want you to become alarmed here. We're leaving right now, but you might want to get a flight booked so you can get home because your airline went out of business. I just saw it on the news. Bye. Oh, it was an all-time great moment. Now, in the opening signature for Wrestling Challenge, in things that annoy me for some reason, the Twin Towers are shown, even though that they've just broken up with the Boss Man thing that I alluded to. Also, the Rougeaus, who have not been seen since the Royal Rumble, but hey, you know, this taping's only taking place 2 days afterwards. So why don't we go, actually, I should not forget that the graphic for Bret the Hitman Hart versus Shawn Michaels is spelled wrong. And I guess that's a slight that Sean vowed to never forget, thinking, if I ever win a title in this promotion, I'm going to make sure that I don't lose it in the ring. So anyway, the first match, Brutus the Barber Beefcake taking on Pete Sanchez, or is it Sanchez? I'm not sure. It's the same guy from 1983 WWF television, Sanchez. The problem that always throws me is if you look at his cage match, it goes back to like 1961, and I refuse to believe that it's the same guy. There's footage of a Pete Sanchez from 1966, and I can't confirm, but I also can't deny that it's the same guy. All I know is he's facing Beefcake, and he's got kind of a big mullet going on, so, you know, I think we know what's going to happen here. Now, Brutus had a feud with Rick Martel at the end of 89 that lasted approximately 17 minutes that pretty much everybody has forgotten, because when you get to the pay-per-view, People remember the pay-per-view matches. They don't remember these little things like Beefcake cutting up Martel's clothes on television quite as much. The Genius versus Beefcake at Rumble, which is a bizarre double DQ to set up the feud with Mr. Perfect, who comes in for the beatdown after Genius gets a little taken off the top. Perfect does make sense for where Beefcake's level is, because he main evented two pay-per-views in 1989. Granted, it was because he's Hogan's buddy, but hey, I mean, you know, it is what it is. Beefcake was pretty over, despite what Conrad Thompson might have to say about it. The only thing, though, with Beefcake that kind of dominates his feuds is you just sit there wondering, is he actually going to cut the other guy's hair? Because it never happened with Honky. It did happen with Ron Bass, but other than that, he actually got his hair cut by Randy Savage. I don't think Mr. Perfect is going to let that happen, right?
Brutus the Barber Beefcake, you stuck your nose in Mr. Perfect's business by cutting the Genius's hair.
But you also found out you never, ever crossed Mr. Perfect.
I'm not sure what the end game of Mr. Perfect getting a haircut in that feud would have been. I mean, could they have sold it as ramen noodles? That's entirely possible, except I think Dolph Ziggler probably would have found a way to steal it, you know, since he pretty much has stolen Mr. Perfect's, like, whole oeuvre with the overselling and all that. The difference, of course, being that Dolph Ziggler sucks and Mr. Perfect was great. Sanchez, no clean break for him, so he actually gains the early advantage, and a reversal of a corner whip leads to a backdrop, so Beefcake is not lacking control for very long, and then he hits a bell ringer, which is basically getting the guy between his legs. I know that sounds like whatever, but he just kind of jumps up and down. It's certainly a very 1980s style move taking place here in January of 1990 as this is taped. And then Beefcake puts the two hands up in the sleep position, like, oh, so he's going for the go to sleep right now. But no, instead of putting his man in a fireman's carry, it's just the regular Irish whip sleeper hold. And he puts Sanchez out fairly quickly. And then when he cuts the hair, I'm a little bit disappointed, because this mullet control program that he has, which is certainly just for the enhancement guys who are too cheap to get a haircut, because you get a little bit more by agreeing to get the haircut, and then they clean you up when you go backstage. Well, he cut barely any of Sanchez's hair, and there was a lot to go on. So I'm not particularly happy about that, but oh well. I mean, I guess we got four more months of Beefcake matches left before he has the parasailing accident in the summer.
From the World Wrestling Federation magazine, this is Special Report.
Hello, everyone. I'm Lord Alfred Hayes. WrestleMania 6 grows ever closer. Sunday, April the 1st, at Sky Dome, Toronto, Canada.
I've said it before, but it bears repeating. I'm actually a fan of the Sky Dome in Toronto. Is it a monument to what the world was like in 1989? Yes, it is. It's kind of the last of the old concrete bowls with some technology thrown in. The retractable roof was very new. They tried that in Montreal with the Olympic Stadium, and it failed miserably, but luckily, that has survived in Toronto. In fact, I think they renovated the roof around 2017, where now they can close it in half the time that they could before. Obviously, it's going to be closed for Mania itself. I am going to be objective, and I'm going to take a step back and say that the buildup with Warrior and Hogan, where you have Jesse changing sides every week on Superstars or who he thinks is going to win, you have the dueling promos, objectively, it's a very good build. The problem with it is you're putting the Warrior right next to Hulk Hogan, and he cannot compete on a promo level with Hogan at all, at least in terms of relating to me, you know, 10-year-old wrestling fan in Massachusetts. But maybe that's just me, but I think back to 1989, the year before, when you got the same style of build where you have Savage and Hogan doing back-to-back promos, where I've talked many, many episodes ago about how the sort of Rashomon effect, where Savage and Hogan were talking about what had happened with Elizabeth, and they saw the same thing, but they are just doing two completely different perspectives. Well, here, the Hogan and Warrior, they have their run-in at the Royal Rumble. They have a little run-in on Saturday night's main event where Hogan is clotheslined accidentally by Warrior, and then you have these kind of happy accidents that happen between the two in the lead-up, and you get the Ultimate Challenge. But to go to my point, listen to the two back-to-back. We're going to start with Hogan because he does go first. They each get about a minute, and look at what these two guys are doing with the time.
Ultimate Warrior! Me and my Hulkamaniacs put the WWF Championship on the line. We challenge you, Warrior. We've got to know what the strongest force is in the WWF. And I swear by the number one Hulkamaniac up there, Ultimate Warrior, the darkness that you press your opponents into before you beat them, if that's the same darkness that makes your soul live, if that's where your heart is at, if you ride your Harley Davidson side by side with a devil, and if I find out that the power you possess comes from drinking the sweat from the devil's armpit, by God, I'll strike you down, Ultimate Warrior. What you gonna do when Hulkamania and the Ultimate Challenge destroys you?
Well, I could have done without the drinking sweat from the devil's armpit thing, although it's still some pretty good imagery by Hogan. Stuff that I can relate to. You know, he's talking to me like a human being. On the flip side, you have the Ultimate Warrior, and this is by far my least favorite Ultimate Warrior era of promos, the lead-up to WrestleMania 6, where he's just out of his mind. He makes absolutely no sense. It was the same thing on the main event on NBC. I don't know if it was better or worse, but you be the judge.
Things that hang from my body and the reasons I paint my face only add more area for more warriors to hang on. You, Hulk Hogan, see things as you will, but I need not come from behind or take a cheap shot at anyone or anything. You, Hulk Hogan, will only be approached by the warriors face to face, eye to eye. I bring you, Hulk Hogan, the one and only Ultimate Challenge.
He need not come from behind. Well, isn't that Dana's call at the end of the day? Anyway, Jack Tunney has got to get involved in this because it's not enough to just have these two guys and announce the match. We're going to have Jack Tunney. And this is actually good because I want to see how he has his desk set up. Are we going to have like the weird forest of parts unknown behind his desk that's clearly not Connecticut? It definitely is a parts unknown vibe. But Tunney, I don't know what was going on. He must think he's some sort of American president despite being a Canadian, because he's got a U.S. flag on his desk, which, by the way, WrestleMania is going to be in Canada, but that's okay. All right. The lapel pin is not a U.S. flag. It's a WWF lapel pin. Probably sell that on eBay for a nice little mint if he was still alive, of course. And he's got basically like pictures, portraits of the Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan over his shoulder. It's a very hilarious image.
On April 1st in Toronto, Canada at Sky Dome, the World Wrestling Federation will present WrestleMania. At this time, I am happy to announce the main event in which World Wrestling Federation champion Hulk Hogan will meet the Intercontinental champion, the Ultimate Warrior. Unquestionably, this is the greatest main event ever signed in World Wrestling Federation history. Never before have two men been so equally matched in popularity, in strength, and in stamina. However, the only question yet to be resolved is, whose championship will be defended? That question will be answered at a later date. Thank you.
What an insult to Hogan to say that he and Warrior are equally matched in stamina, considering Warrior's the guy who runs to the ring and is completely blown up 2 minutes into every match. I was just like dying listening to that. But yes, they had not yet announced which title was going to be on the line.
title for title. Hey, isn't it obvious that it's always going to be the higher title that's at stake? The world that we live in is basically just troll-filled at this point. But 29, 30 years ago, things were a little different. It would have been an ace troll move by Jack Tunney to announce, yeah, you know what? This is going to be an Intercontinental title match. And the world title is not going to be on the line. That would have been so great. But of course, that was not going to happen because it wouldn't have made any damn sense. But it still would have been funny.
Sideburns and my hair slicked back. I'm coming to your town in my pink Cadillac. I'm just a honky tonk man.
He's a honky tonk man.
I'm just a honky tonk man.
He's a honky tonk man.
I'm just a honky tonk man. I'm cool. I'm cocky. I'm bad.
It would not be too long after this, WrestleMania 6 to be precise, that we would bid a tearful farewell to the honky tonk man theme, cool, cocky, and bad, that did not come out until near the end of 1987, because that was on the Piledriver album. But we got a good 2.5 years out of it before it had to be replaced by a hunka 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 hunka. Sorry, I got stuck there for a second. I don't know how many hunkas there actually are in it, but he's just the honky tonk man in that song that I just played, and now he's got a tag team partner in the form of Greg the Hammer Valentine. Now, he does not have the black hair yet, but they are calling themselves Rhythm and Blues in their inset promo.
This is the greatest tag team ever assembled. It's red hot. It's Rhythm and Blues.
That's right. The honky man, he's got the rhythm. And the hammer will give you the blues.
These are my number one hits, Rhythm and Blues.
Indeed, these two guys were a team at WrestleMania 5 against the Hart Foundation. Now, I think that was more of a function of trying to get both of those guys on the card, and you weren't going to have them in singles matches. So just pair them together, put them against the Harts. You still have the Harts with the lingering issue for Jimmy Hart from the year before, and they set it up on Superstars not long before that. But now this team is being formalized because the Honky Tonk Man had kind of fallen on hard times since losing the Intercontinental title. Yeah, you get the rematches with the Warrior, but quite frankly, he's past his sell-by date, and I don't think it helps, because I think a comparison for the Honky Tonk Man is The Miz, except for the fact that Honky Wayne Ferris, a bit of a dink at times behind the scenes, or so I've heard, he's kind of like insolent Miz. If Miz was completely insolent all the time, instead of being this consummate company guy who says everything that they need him to say in documentaries. And Valentine is coming off the Ronnie Garvin feud, which he lost, but heels generally lose feuds, especially in the WWF. And there was really no place else for him to go. I mean, where are you going to put him from a singles perspective, except for my catch-all, which is to put him opposite Tito Santana, because that's what you always do. I just imagine Tito getting in there when Valentine dyes his hair black. Like, what the hell happened to you, man? We used to have matches all the time. You had blonde hair, and it was fine. And now you had to go and screw it up. The best part about this bout is the opponents of the Honky Tonk Man and Greg the Hammer Valentine are the Mulkeys in from the NWA. This is very strange to see them in a WWF ring, but they had a few shots. But mainly their claim to fame is NWA, the TBS show on Saturday 6:05 from about 85 through 87. Might have bled into 88 a little. 87, and I've gone over this before. They won a qualifying match for the Crockett Cup over a team that they had built up for a couple of weeks called the Gladiators. In reality, just a couple of other job guys under mask. So pretty well built, I think, with those guys. A very brief flash of popularity. Another person that this made sense for, other than Honky and the Hammer, is Jimmy Hart. Because, as I had mentioned earlier, the Rougeaus are now gone, despite them being in the signature at the top of the show. So now, Jimmy needs a tag team. All these managers, you know, there's a certain pecking order, and they all have one tag team. And you can't have two tag teams. That's why when Fuji brings in the Orient Express, he's got to sell off Warlord and Barbarian. I think it's some sort of antitrust issue within the WWF bylaws, although I'm not entirely sure. And while there wasn't going to be a tag team title run for Rhythm and Blues at any point, especially once they start feuding with the Bushwhackers at WrestleMania 6, they are in the picture towards the end of the year as the main house show opponents of the Hart Foundation around the time of the Survivor Series. And if you'll recall, they are on the team with The Undertaker and Ted DiBiase opposite the Hart Foundation on the other side. That's kind of the way you can, you know, what the feud was. You know, you just take it at Survivor Series in 80, 89, and 90. Anyway, once you get past that, it becomes a little bit tougher. The back of Honky's tights, you'd often put an Elvis song there. And he put Twist and Shout, which I thought was really strange because I know of no Elvis version of that song. I mean, I listen to Elvis radio, maybe not all the time, but enough where I would have heard an Elvis version of Twist and Shout. I mean, I've heard Elvis do a bunch of other songs, like his version of Sweet Caroline blows Neil Diamond out of the water. But anyway, so Gorilla, he's a WWF guy, tried and true. Everybody knows that. He owned a piece of the company when it was the Capital Wrestling Corporation. So, of course, when he sees these invaders, the Mulkeys, come in from the NWA, he's not going to stand for this shit.
Sooner or later, Jell is a team.
Well, if you've got experience, if you've got know-how, if you've got technique, and if you've got the ability and the kind of experience that these two have had, they can't help but Jell.
And to that, they have some great leadership.
Of course, it doesn't take much gelling against the Mulkey brothers here, but they certainly leave a lot to be desired.
Now, to anybody who's offended by that, I'm going to remind you that shortly after WrestleMania 3, I don't know what happened behind the scenes, Gorilla Monsoon said the same thing about Aretha Franklin, saying that she left a lot to be desired. I think maybe she didn't autograph something for him or was a diva. The Gorilla Monsoon completely shocked that Aretha Franklin acted like a diva. He must be alone in that category. But, yep, Gorilla's always going to be a WWF guy, and that is part of his charm. Now, you wonder, how many tags are the Mulkeys going to be allowed? You know they're going to get at least one because this isn't Memphis. And are they going to be able to get two? And no, they are only allowed one tag, get a big backdrop, and Honky just kind of in there doing his usual crappy offense. And the shake, rattle, and roll finishes, but honestly, it was really more of a shake and roll. There was really not much of a rattle. It was basically just like a normal neck breaker. But that's not what I want to point attention to at the end of this match, because when he pins the man, picks up the 1-2-3, they're celebrating in the ring, and while he's still got the blonde hair at this point, Greg the Hammer Valentine, maybe he senses where everything is going, and he decides to do one of the, even for white people, okay, this was a really awkward dance.
What's this now?
We're going to have a little singing, perhaps.
I don't know how to describe what Greg Valentine was doing there, other than to say that it was a less rhythmic version of what Earthquake would do in his promos, you know, with the back and forth, like, I gotta pee. I think Valentine really just had to pee. I mean, there's no other explanation for it, but, yep, he knows where this is going. So Tony immediately is just like, I'm so disgusted by this, throw it to the event center right now. So we go to Sean Mooney, and I will tell you that I had access to three different versions of this edition of Wrestling Challenge that had different event centers. One of them actually had the event centers cut out, and obviously I'm not going to choose that one because some of the gems from this show come in these little 45-second promos. The second one was the first show in Nashville, but I didn't like the selection of guys because this Cap Center show in Landover, Maryland, the third one, not only is it an interesting venue, one of the bigger venues for the WWF on the East Coast, but some crazy matches on this show that just absolutely sort of blew my mind. But in terms of the venue, the Cap Center, I lived down in D.C. area for about 2.5-3 years. I never went there because, well, it got torn down in the middle of me living there in 2002. The Capitals and the Bullets, I think they were still the Bullets when they left there to go to the MCI Center in downtown D.C. They left there in 1997, so just kind of was there for about a five-year span. Tore it down at the end of 02, and they redeveloped it into a mall in 2003. And now it's being torn down. It was torn down starting in 2017, and they're building a mixed-use deal with some businesses, some housing, which I think will probably work out okay because the subway, the metro line in D.C. actually goes to there, and real estate in the city is always worth much more when you're near a subway line. Just a few facts about the Cap Center, because, you know, I guess Conrad said, I don't know when I'm ever going to talk about the Cap Center again, Roll Tide, even though they suck and didn't make the college football playoff. First indoor arena with a video replay board, and also the first indoor arena, at least in the United States, with luxury boxes, which would become, you know, a huge issue later on, and would see a lot of stadiums getting built in the 1990s, and now we're seeing yet another generation of it. As I said, this is a fascinating card with a lot of permutations that, of course, go back to the 1988 Survivor Series, because our main event is the teammates from that show, the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase, with Akeem facing off against Jake the Snake Roberts and the Ultimate Warrior. So those two guys from 1991 and their feud, they're teaming up here in early 1990. And there's a special referee that they have not announced for it yet, even though the show's only 2 weeks away. Well, that referee would turn out to be the Big Boss Man. So a very interesting main event. And thankfully, we do get a promo from the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and Akeem. And let us not forget that Ted DiBiase's first WWF matches in 1987, where they had to turn him heel for the Houston audience, was against Akeem's former name, or former personality, the One Man Gang. So, it's just so interesting to see them together here.
Well, Jake, at least you're smart enough to at least attempt to prepare yourself for what I have for you. You steal $1 million worth of my property, and you go out and you hire the Ultimate Warrior as backup, and you get Jack Tunney in your hip pocket with a special referee who I'm sure is going to be there to try and keep us in line. We don't know who it is. Maybe it's Gorilla Monsoon. Maybe it's Hulk Hogan himself. It doesn't matter, Jake, because I'm going to do whatever it takes to get the job done. The Boss Man, he was not smart enough to take the money of the Million Dollar Man. But Akeem here, he knows the value of a dollar. And for enough of this right here, Ultimate Warrior, he'll take care of you. Jake, you belong to me.
I am just endlessly fascinated. I'll never get tired of thinking about Ted DiBiase's character and just his networking skill in general. Because he had the bodyguard Virgil for the entire, at least up until 1991, and they split. But let's think about before that. He had positive relationships with all the managers. So basically, that showed me that even more than his money, and yeah, the money probably helped a little bit, but his networking skill, because with Slick, he clearly has a positive relationship with him. With Heenan, he had the whole Andre thing in 1988 where they had that transaction. He also had the transaction with Hercules as well that kind of went sour. But obviously, they have an agreement between the two of them. And Jimmy Hart and DiBiase, you don't hear as much between those two earlier on. But later on, he becomes the manager of Money, Inc. So clearly, there's some sort of relationship there. Not to mention Sherry, and the fact that Ted DiBiase and the Macho King Randy Savage are secret best friends at this point, owning a timeshare in Zeus for the second half of 1989, teaming up, you know, with each other at the Royal Rumble very early on in that match. And I don't know. Ted DiBiase would have had the best LinkedIn profile, I think, of any WWF guy from the late 80s or the early 90s. Also at the Cap Center, Bret the Hitman Hart, even though they are on track for the tag team titles, the Hart Foundation is, in 6 months, and they're going to be in a tag match at WrestleMania 6, even though it lasts about 15 seconds. He's going to be in a weird singles match against Greg the Hammer Valentine at the Cap Center, and I say that it's weird because the Hammer would have already dyed his hair black by that point, but it wouldn't have aired on TV.
You know, for the past couple of years, I've seen these various wrestlers carted back to the dress room on stretchers. And I always wonder, who did it to somebody this time? Who crippled this guy? You know, it's always been Greg the Hammer Valentine, noted in the WWF for crippling more wrestlers than anybody else. Well, let me say something, Hammer. You're stepping in the ring with the Hitman, the excellence of execution. And that's not going to happen this time. I'm going to take you to the distance.
You have to admit, Brett's getting a little bit better at the solo promos at this point in time. But then at the end, he kind of loses a bit. Like, he's going to take the Hammer the distance. Is he promising a time limit draw? Anyway, I'm just reminded of the fact that the first live wrestling match that I ever saw was a Bret Hart time limit draw against the Barbarian at the Boston Garden. I can recall the fans having tears in their eyes as they rose as one in the Boston Garden to thank Bret for his performance in that match. Yeah, read Bret Hart's book if you want to get the reference on that one. So many people coming up to Bret with tears in their eyes. Anyway, coming up next, we got Coco Beware taking on Jerry Lou. I can only assume that Jerry Lou, who has no cage match profile or any of that stuff, is just some sort of portmanteau of Jerry Jarrett and Lou Thesz, or Jerry Lawler and Lou Thesz. Who really knows? But Coco, you think of him as, oh, he's the jobber to the stars. Like, oh, no. His role was, on house shows, fire up the crowd either in the opening match, most likely, or you have the intermission, and the fans are coming back, and you want to get them back into it, and Coco Beware will do that thing where he'll clap, and he'll get everybody into it. That's an extremely valuable role, and there's not too many guys who do that as well as Coco Beware was doing it. And the wins that he was picking up, granted, none of these were pushed guys. Al Perez, Black Bart, Buddy Rose, you know, unfortunately, had kind of fallen on hard times. But Coco had a very interesting match against Frenchie Martin at Madison Square Garden in March of 1990. Not for anything that happened, but because there's a version of it, and it's peculiar because it must have been dubbed over later because it's Vince McMahon and Jesse. And I know Jesse was not doing any house shows after about 1986. And Vince doing MSG was unusual because he only had ever filled in for Gorilla in about 88. When he had a heart attack around the time of the Royal Rumble. Coco, when you look at his results from shortly before this, this big gap from October of 1989 and in November of 1989, and that is because October 12th in Belgium was the famous incident where WWF executive Jim Troy said something racial to Coco, and he is not the guy to actually trifle with. So Coco pretty much beat his ass, which he's lucky he didn't give him the full Memphis jobber treatment, because that famous match where Coco just beat the ever-loving shit out of some jobber. But Coco kind of got summarily dismissed for a period of time until they figured out, oh yeah, this guy used a racial slur towards him, so he's probably justified. So Coco brought back in, and at this point in time, Coco, he's got the Demolition Man hair going on. He's like Wesley Snipes, but this is some 3.5 years before that movie came out, before Dennis Rodman emulated that. Arm drag and clap for the crowd. That's actually a proprietary Coco Beware, so I can't say babyface move set number 7 or whatever. That's Coco Beware only.
Nice backdrop.
Coco gets a good backdrop.
I think Coco would like to have his matches while his music is still playing throughout the entire match.
Yeah, I bet you didn't know that Gorilla Monsoon laid all the groundwork for the New Jack template in ECW, where Natural Born Killers would be playing the entire match. It'd be funny if Coco did his entire match with that song, and New Jack did his entire matches, and they used "Everybody Get Up, Everybody Get Down" as he's throwing a trash can into the ring and hitting dudes with golf clubs. I'm going to go back. Coco Beware's record for 1990, and I know cage match is usually incomplete, but 107 wins and 25 losses for the year. Now, he lost on pay-per-view, lost to the model Rick Martel in the opener at WrestleMania 6, but that's better than the 98 Yankees. Coco Beware, better than the 1998 Yankees. Coco heads to the top rope, and I'm holding my breath because I know he's going to do the missile dropkick. The question Is he going to do it and land on his feet? And indeed, he does. And I'll put a GIF file of that in the replies when I post this on Twitter. I was so excited about that. And then he follows up with the Ghostbuster, although it's really Brainbuster. I wanted to find that Japanese announcer saying that, but I looked way too long for an exact clip of a guy saying that. But I should just pull out the driver. But anyway, Coco Beware, you gotta love him. I don't like him getting any grief for being in the WWE Hall of Fame because he did his role pretty much better than anybody else ever has. And plus, he's like the one guy who had an animal with him who was actually good to the animal. And I think he deserves some credit for that.
Right now, let's go to Mean Gene Okerlund.
All right, my guest, ladies and gentlemen, this week is one of the great veterans in the World Wrestling Federation. He is from Harlem. He is none other than Bad News Brown.
Yeah, I chose this show mainly because of Brett versus Shawn for the first time, and then you get the little bonus of, well, they recap the superstars with DiBiase and Jake the Snake and the Big Boss Man and his whole involvement and him turning babyface. But this just keeps getting better. A Bad News Brown interview segment? Oh my god. Everything here is right up my alley. This show just keeps getting better. Now, they're talking about the Royal Rumble, which, you know, only took place 2 days before this, as it's being taped. And Okerlund refers to Bad News as one of the favorites in that as a sort of oblique reference to WrestleMania 4 because he mentions that he had won that type of match in the past. I mean, after all, his character, he comes from Harlem, Rumbles are who he is. So he feels like, well, he should have been able to come out on top there, but things did not quite work out. So what say you, Bad News?
Let me tell you something, and let me tell these beer belly sharecroppers one thing. When you grow up on the streets of Harlem, Friday, Saturday, and especially Sunday is Rumble night. So this was old hat to me. But it's a shame when a man like myself gets into that ring there with those spineless cockroaches, and they did everything in their power to get away from me. They ran, they hit. I even had a couple of them when I got near them jump over the top rope by themselves.
Liar.
I think it's a terrible shame, but I was in cruise control, and I was kicking booty out there.
Gorilla always had the best little editorial comments in these interview segments. Like when Jesse Ventura was on the Brother Love Show right before SummerSlam 88, and Jesse was like, I could come out of retirement tomorrow and win the world title if I wanted to. Gorilla under his breath, you could barely hear him. He says, it's hard to be humble when you're great. He was always so good at that. And I don't remember anybody fleeing Bad News as he described, you know, pulling what Keithy would describe as the Hercules from the Saturday Night's Main Event Royal Rumble from 1991, where he throws himself over the top rope because he missed his spot. And Okerlund takes exception as well because Rowdy Roddy Piper tossed Bad News out of the match. And Bad News did that Hulk Hogan World War III, or actually the 89 Royal Rumble is where he did it to the Big Boss Man, where Bad News Brown pulled Piper out from the outside.
Not only are you losing your hair and your mind, you're losing your eyesight. Let me tell you one thing, and tell these beer belly sharecroppers something. When I was in there, I had some geek down and I was giving it to him, the what for. That little so-called, what is he, she, or whatever, came in with that skirt into the ring, and when I was getting ready to make a move and throw this idiot that I was working on out, he took that skirt off, and I tripped over it. That's how I fell out the ring.
Uh-oh. I don't remember that.
Watch out.
Of course you don't remember that.
Trouble.
Because you ain't got no brains, that's why.
It's at this point that Rowdy Roddy Piper has made his way out into the arena, but he's being held back, and there's an exchange of words, and I'm actually mildly surprised. I was thinking, Piper's a little too big to be on Challenge. He might be like the biggest star, because you don't see Hogan on Wrestling Challenge, maybe an occasional interview segment. You don't see the Warrior all that often on Challenge. This is where you see maybe the lesser guys, but here he is, and he's ready to fight, and who better to do a pull-apart brawl than Rowdy Roddy Piper? And he's trying to fight his way there, but Bad News has got the high ground up on the podium. And it's going to be an uphill battle for the Rowdy one. And as bad news is trash-talking him from up on high, I had forgotten that this feud, even before Piper decided to inexplicably paint himself half-black, apparently it might have been explainable because there were certain odd racial elements that were going on even right here.
I know you and your kind like to look like me, so why don't you switch on down to the beach here a few miles and get yourself a little suntan. Maybe you'll look a little better, huh?
Keep running your mouth, bad news. You're going to be in big
one
trouble.
One other thing, too. Let me give you a piece of advice. If you're going to insist on wearing that skirt, if you're going to wear that skirt, I suggest that you shave those bony legs of yours because you look terrible.
That's it.
Piper exploding out of bad news, and they couldn't even hold him back now. He's going berserk.
Look at this. All kinds of help coming out now. Trying to keep these two guys apart. Well, he asked for it.
He really did. Bad news had a lot of talk going toward the way of the rally one, and that's all the men could stand. Piper exploded. Oh, my goodness.
It's kind of funny when you think about it that Bad News Brown is accusing Rowdy Roddy Piper of trying to be black. Apparently, that's the genesis of the whole half-black thing. Not Piper's, well, I did it because Cyndi Lauper came out with True Colors shortly before that. That's in the WrestleMania 30 book from a few years ago. It's just complete nonsense. But yeah, Piper's the dude who wants to be black in a promotion that has Dusty Rhodes in it at the same time. You'd think maybe Bad News might take it up with him, but sorry, he's already feuding with Savage, and he is just apparently unavailable. And although, you know, the Dusty Savage feud worked out okay, maybe switch the two, have Dusty feud with Bad News Brown and have Piper feud with Savage. Now, that would be pretty good, because that would certainly carry a B-House show program if you did that, Piper and Savage. Of course, since that didn't happen, I guess they had a handful of matches over the years. I'm just kind of leading myself to disappointment. Although, not as disappointing as this Piper-Bad News feud turned out to be. Because you do the match at WrestleMania 6, it ends in like a double DQ, double countout, whatever the hell it was, because they weren't going to have Bad News lose, and they sure as hell weren't going to have Piper lose. So it was one of those things where it was far less than the sum of its parts, because you know me, I turned this podcast into a Bad News Brown tribute show for like 3 weeks, and I like me some Piper as well, but the two of these guys together, for whatever reason, it just didn't work.
Right, Shawn Michaels. There's Shawn. He'll be facing the Hitman, Bret Hart, in our feature matchup this week on the Wrestling Challenge. It's going to be a very interesting matchup.
Now, there's an understatement that this is going to be a very interesting matchup. The first ever between Bret the Hitman Hart and Shawn Michaels that would end up on the Bret versus Shawn DVD that came out years ago. Now, if you ask me, if you say, oh, Pete, what's your opinion on, you know, the whole Bret and Shawn thing? I would just say to you, all I see is two guys who were teammates at the 1988 Survivor Series. But beyond that, you can tell from listening to me now for 146 episodes that I'm very clearly a Bret guy. I don't know if it's because he likes hockey, because he's from Canada. I think it's because his philosophy of professional wrestling is more in line with what I want. Like, Shawn Michaels in a real fight, I mean, we saw what the result of that was when he decided to get wasted in Syracuse and picked, you know, basically had a run-in with the wrong guy. I mean, if something like that in Syracuse, what happened to him, stuff like that didn't happen to Bret Hart. And I'm not saying that because he was some, you know, bar, you know, tough man who would get into fights and just, you know, kill everybody the way Haku would. And I'm going to say that Bret is no angel himself. I mean, if you've read his book, I know I referred to it earlier, but like the sleeping around with women, you know, that's one thing. I disagree with Bret on quite a bit. But come on. I mean, the comparison between these two guys, I mean, to me, there is no comparison. Because with Shawn, these days, and it's funny because you had Bret signing the 20-year contract in 1996 with the whole notion that later on he would become a behind-the-scenes guy. Eventually, what would become, I would guess, the Dusty Rhodes role in NXT that he had until he passed in 2015. when you think about Brett in that spot, yeah, I could see NXT as being fairly similar to, you know, that sort of vision. Now, ever since Dusty passed to 2015, now you get Shawn kind of in that role. And all these matches now, and yeah, they're fine, they're well done, and I enjoy them to an extent. But, you know, why does everything have to friggin' be WrestleMania 25 against The Undertaker? I'm so goddamn tired of it. I mean, not everything has to be a 26-minute epic in order to be a main event. You could have an 8 to 10-minute main event, and it would be fine. It's what you do in those 8 to 10 minutes. And some of these matches are just so long for the sake of being long. I hate to be old guy shakes his fist at a cloud or anything, but, like, Johnny Gargano, for God's sakes, some of these matches, the dude kicks out, like, basically, Lee Oswald shoots him in the head three times from the, you know, book depository building, and Gargano kicks out at 2.5. I mean, give me a break. Anyway, those matches are kind of, like I said, they're fine. They're very, you know, they're well executed. And all. They're just too long. And, like, not everything has to be a freaking epic. And I'm pinning that all on Shawn Michaels because I don't like him. I don't like him one bit. But anyway, this is a much simpler time. When Brett and Shawn liked each other, there was no complications. There was no real reason for me to even hate Shawn Michaels at this point. Because even though the Rockers were getting fired about every 9 months, like they were an Irish wife getting pregnant or something, it's kind of an odd face matchup. And I say odd because at this point, there's been no sort of build to the Rockers turning heel or to the Hart Foundation turning heel, although there was maybe a thought in the back of the mind that they would turn heel and come at Demolition, and Demolition would stay baby faces. But I think that that would have been a mistake because there's a lot of money in Bret Hart as a babyface, particularly in the overseas markets. Now, the Rockers as heels, that would have been interesting. I mean, like I said, they were kind of, you know, dicks behind the scenes anyway. You know, all of the issues that those two guys had. I mean, you just have them be their normal persona. They were like that in Memphis when they showed up there in late 87 and early 88 when they were doing their one-year penance after getting fired the first time in the WWF. That's one of the Memphis episodes that I have to do, is the Rockers turning up there. See, I don't hold everything against Shawn Michaels to the point where I won't do episodes because of him. I only save that for Brian Blair. One of the things I loved about the 1988 Survivor Series, not to bring that up yet again, is Jesse Ventura picking on Gorilla for making some horrible football bets and derisively calling him the Baron of Atlantic City. Well, Gorilla decides to handicap this one.
That Shawn Michaels and Bret the Hitman have been used to tagging out at various times. He won't be able to in this match.
Well, they certainly won't. Their partners, of course, are at ringside. However, this is a single matchup. And if I were a betting type person, Tony Giovanni, I'd put my money on a Hitman. Hitman has had more singles competition, I'm sure, than Shawn Michaels has had.
Yes, Gorilla, if you were a betting man, but only if. But there was actually some good handicapping because Bret has had singles matches pretty much in every year that he's been in the WWF. Yeah, the team with Neidhart comes along in 85, but he came in, I guess he was kind of paired with various guys in late 84, but he did have some singles matches. And then in 86, he's got matches with Steamboat early in the year that he felt should have been on the WrestleMania 2 card. And as you go along, you get Savage on Saturday Night's Main Event in late 87. Much of the summer of 88, he's in singles competition. Much of the spring of 1989, he's in singles competition as well. So, yeah, on the other side, the Rockers, you don't really see Shawn Michaels as a single. After all, Gorilla is calling him a tag team specialist basically every other sentence. As Anvil is responsible for handing out the shades to the person in the front row, which is funny because the person promptly drops them. It probably broke, but hey, that's fine. So as the first lockup, we get nothing. But Bret complains about his getting his hair pulled, which is actually kind of an allegory for the entire relationship between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. In the second lockup, Bret ends up getting a wrist lock, but Shawn counters it quickly. They trade a little bit of arm work, and Bret ends up in a hammer lock before he gets a back elbow from Shawn. Bret then catches Shawn with an inverted atomic drop and hits him with a really big clothesline. I will say this for Shawn. He could sell clotheslines like nobody's business. I'm thinking Akeem at WrestleMania 5, and even here with Bret. That was a pretty big one, but then Bret misses with an elbow, Sean grabs a side headlock and then flips out of a back suplex attempt by Brett and hits the Hitman with a dropkick. Up top, Sean goes, but Brett is actually playing possum. He slams Michaels off the top rope and hits several European uppercuts, or actually two of them. But then on the third one, Sean catches the arm and scores a backslide, which gets a two count. Then Sean flips out of a backbreaker attempt off an Irish whip. Brett was going for the side backbreaker, but he flips out of it, and he hits a slam and a standing leg drop. And then they end up hitting head-to-head as they run the ropes, as they're cutting a pretty good pace early in this match, so you get a little bit of a rest for both guys. They battle over a vertical suplex where both guys try to get it, and they kind of do that thing where they move the leg forward to lock. I don't know why you wouldn't just always do that, but hey, you know, it's pro wrestling. I have to let some things go. And they end up battling over into the ropes, and neither guy wants to break cleanly here. And there's an argument ensuing, and Brett hits Sean with a straight right hand. So I guess that means the Hitman might be playing heel here, but he got a pretty positive reaction from the crowd in Fort Myers, so I'm not sure. It seems to be a little bit down the middle, but I think Brett, as of now, is the most popular guy in this match for this crowd. Marty Jannetty is up on the apron because he's upset over that little sucker punch, another thing that Brett would be famous for much later on after a match with Sean. And Marty lays hands on Brett, and I'm wondering, where the hell is the DQ here? Because that the referee saw it. You could see the official in the background, and he sees Marty lays hands on Brett, and he doesn't call for the DQ. Meanwhile, on the other side of the ring, Sean hits the anvil first because he's up on the apron, and now the bell rings, and you get a brawl with all four guys. And our official decision for the first matchup between Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart.
The referee's decision here to disqualify both men.
Well, that's the only thing he could have done, I think.
Well, obviously.
I disagree with that assessment with extreme prejudice because, as I mentioned, it was Marty Jannetty who hit Brett first. But even if you're a referee who's going to allow that to go because you got something going on the other side of the ring, even there, Sean hits the anvil. The anvil did not hit him first. So this match should have been Bret Hart defeats Shawn Michaels by disqualification. And I'm going to give you one guess who the referee was here. Yes, it was Earl Hebner screwing Brett in a match against Shawn Michaels. I mean, you want to talk about time is a flat circle, that sort of stuff. What a shocker. Earl Hebner screws Brett against Shawn Michaels in 1990. But Brett does get one over in the end. Yes, they do have the little brawl, but I'm going to say Brett gets over a little bit here because as they go to break, Tony, with a little bit of a nod to Brett, I think, in a very subtle fashion.
Great confrontation, and then tempers exploded here on the Wrestling Challenge.
That might have been inadvertent on Tony's part, but the fact that he called it the Wrestling Challenge and you have Bret Hart, a guy who likes to add the word the in front of things that makes it sound really awkward, I think that that was an inadvertent shout out, and he's saying that Bret should have won the match.
WrestleMania 6, Sunday afternoon, April 1, in Toronto, Canada, at Sky Dome. For ticket information, call 416-872-1111. It's the Ultimate Challenge.
If they decide to go back to what is now the Rogers Center for a WrestleMania or maybe even a Royal Rumble, I mean, I'm kind of surprised that they didn't try it for SummerSlam, but then again, with the Blue Jays there, it's a little bit more restrictive. I would definitely be in for that. The other thing about WrestleMania 6 being in Canada is one person would have to change their name, and that would be the former Canadian Earthquake, now known as just Earthquake. Because we can't have that bizarro Toronto crowd cheering just because he's a Canadian Earthquake. A lot of nationalism there. They dropped that right after the Royal Rumble. So really, this is the first match that's airing on television. He had a match on the Superstars taping, but it did not air until after this one. He's taking on Jim Evans, who is the aforementioned one half of the Ding Dongs from the NWA. Also, not to be confused with the Jim Evans, who was an American League umpire at the time in 1990. Although, it is kind of funny that Earthquake is facing Jim Evans because in his tryout matches in the fall of 1989, I believe it was actually in late September, at a couple of TV tapings, one of which had him against Paul Roma, and it was on the unreleased 86 to 95 DVD that came out about a year or two ago. He was known as Earthquake Evans, so he's facing a guy who has that last name. He was managed by Slick in that match. And now when I see John Tenta, just having gone and looked up his age and when he was born fairly recently, I can't get over the fact that John Tenta was 26 years old when this match took place. I think he should just be known as 26-year-old Earthquake for the entirety of 1990, or at least up till June when he turns 27. And then he, of course, become 27-year-old Earthquake. Still, either way, no matter how you slice it, it's remarkable because he has that Arn Anderson disease where he looked exactly the same age for the entire time that he was in there. It's just unfortunate that he looked 41 and 42 when he was only 26 or 27. Starts off with a slam and a clothesline as Gorilla plugs the WWF magazine, which has Hulk Hogan on the cover, but a big article on Earthquake on the inside, because that push is just around the corner after WrestleMania. There is a certain point, it's probably that main event show that I did on the Place to Be podcast earlier this week, where Earthquake just passes Dino Bravo and leaves him in the dust. In fact, you could probably even maybe argue that it happened a little bit earlier than that, because in my opinion, having reviewed the 1990 Royal Rumble match on my old blog, he was the third best guy in the match. I don't want to be too hard on Jim Evans. He was probably just trying to feed his family or whatever it was, but he's going to have to spend the rest of his life saying that he was a ding-dong in the NWA, or, you know, that he was one half of that tag team. But his offense in this match was just profoundly stupid, that mostly consisted of him trying to dive into Earthquake with cross bodies, where Earthquake would catch him and hit that power slam, or he would just hold him up there and drive him into the mat, and then Earthquake with the big elbow. You know, everybody talks about the Bret Hart five moves of doom, but Earthquake definitely had his routine, too, with that power slam, elbow, and then, of course, the seated splash, the Earthquake splash.
He's already destroyed a half a dozen rings here in the World Wrestling Federation.
I don't understand that. If he has destroyed six rings, why hasn't he gotten into trouble for that? Like, hey, why don't you take it easy? Or perhaps they could reinforce the ring, as Gorilla was always fond of saying. It's a little strange. It's kind of like a basketball player defacing the court or whatever, or a hockey player deciding, you know what, I'm just going to melt down the ice. I'm going to go break into the ice plant and turn off the compressor. But Earthquake with yet another victory. He's on track to face Hercules at WrestleMania 6, for whatever that's worth, in a match primarily known for Gorilla completely losing track of what was going on and thinking that a live-action Earthquake doing the second splash to Hercules, as he was fond of doing, was a replay of the first one. Very unfortunate moment for Gorilla, who was probably just hungry. His blood sugar was down. He just needed a hot dog or something.
But we are getting close. Just 2 weeks away, the action arrives at the Capitol Center. It will happen Sunday night, beginning at 7:30 p.m., February 25th.
It always struck me as kind of weird that the arena in Landover, Maryland was known as the Capitol Center, but center was spelled C-E-N-T-R-E, i.e. the Canadian version of it. I did find that strange, considering it was so close to the capital of America where we use the E-R spelling. So one of the matches, as I mentioned, was no, it was not Dusty Rhodes against Bad News Brown, the feud that I called for earlier. We got the Macho Man, or Macho King, Randy Savage, taking on Dusty Rhodes, because we got the feud between Sapphire and Queen Sherry, which kicked into high gear at the Royal Rumble in kind of, I don't want to say it was a hidden gem segment, but when I go back and watch that, where Brother Love and Queen Sherry just gang up on Sapphire for about 6 minutes before Sapphire just hauls off and slaps Sherry, it's a pretty funny segment when you go back to it. Now, we got Big Dust here. And I'm kind of wondering, after last week, where we had him, you know, not that long before this, about 14 months before this would have aired, where he's calling out Animal of the Road Warriors for steroid abuse, saying he likes to hang out with hookers and this and that. Let's see where Dusty's going to go this time.
Yeah, let me tell you about it. I was thinking all about it.
The brothers on the street are talking about it. Everybody around the world seen it live. When one Queen Sherry started ridiculing the American dream, the common folk, if you will. I am folk, yes, sir. And Macho Man, the king, if you will, Randy Savage, said, I want Dusty Rhodes, the legendary American dream. Well, you got all of it you can stand, baby. Nobody runs down my people, my common folk, if you will, in public. Much less my Lady Safi. Come in here, darling.
Oh, yeah! Randy King, we got something for you, too!
Who? And I'm going to put it on you like she wrote you.
Every time Sapphire comes out there, she basically says the same thing. Well, we're gonna get you! It's effectively something like that every time. It's the same bit. I wonder what the greatest Sapphire promo is. It's probably something from the 70s in Central States, so clearly it doesn't exist on tape now, because she was a performer back in those days. Another match on that show is Rugged Ronnie Garvin taking on Earthquake. Kind of a standard enhancement, building up the Earthquake a little bit more. Obviously, we just saw him against Jim Evans. And once again, Earthquake, as I mentioned, he's doing that back and forth thing. But I had talked about earlier how I fell ill at the Bruins game on Saturday and left during the second intermission. And with the, you know, just uncontrollable heartburn that I had going on, where I was pacing and kind of, you know, moving back and forth, not dissimilar to what Earthquake does.
Hey, Garvin, you better check your policy, baby. You say what policy? I thought you'd never ask, man. It's your national disaster policy, because you're going to need it when you face the Earthquake, baby.
Ronnie Garvin, I don't know why you're stepping in the ring with me again. You felt the Earthquake once. You attacked Dino Bravo from behind, and you were punching him. He was in the corner trying to get out. Well, I came to help him, and I gave you the Earthquake. And let me tell you, it doesn't stop there. It only gets worse. You're coming in against one of the biggest men in the WWF. And you can't survive. Nobody can survive the Earthquake.
Be ready, Garvin, because the Earthquake will.
It's very interesting that he brought up Dino Bravo, because now I'm realizing that was there actually more to this WrestleMania 5 match that seemingly meant nothing between Dino Bravo and Ronnie Garvin, the last battle of Quebec? I wonder, like, was there some sort of underlying feud going on that they just weren't putting on television between Bravo and Garvin? Was it something with Bravo still with Valentine dating back to the Dream Team days? I know, this is just completely ridiculous. I'm writing my own angle based on just bullshit going through my head.
What's he trying to do? Meanwhile, he's going to be counted outside the ring. Look at this, they're going at it outside. Wait a minute, the Big Boss Man is alive with a save.
I'm always somewhat hesitant on stuff like this because the thought is, well, I could do an entire show on the superstars that has the actual angle where the Big Boss Man turns face rather than just including it with this wrestling challenge where they're looking back on it. But, you know, the fact is that I could get hit by a bus tomorrow, so I should, you know, cover this angle, you know, while it's on the table. It's joined in progress, the match with Ted and Jake. And Slick is out there with Ted DiBiase because of his superior networking skills and just ability to reach out to people of all races, creeds, and personality types. I mean, Heenan, Hart, and Slick are all very, very different people. And Jake and DiBiase, they're brawling outside, and that's where you hear the Boss Man comes in and hits Jake either in the back of the head or in the back of the neck, which, hey, considering where Jake has that neck injury dating back where they have talked about it on TV, you know, it's kind of a rough blow. So Ted, he's really making use of his LinkedIn page, I think, at this point. But the purpose is, Big Boss Man is there for a reason. And he cuffs Jake to the ropes, grabs the snake bag with Damien in it, and he's off. And you think, okay, well, that's it. They'll go to the back, and that's that. Oh, no. This angle's a little different because they just collide it all into the Brother Love Show, which starts immediately. The angle right into the talk show where you're going to have another angle. And it goes without saying, you know, I mentioned it earlier, how Ted and the Big Boss Man are also Survivor Series 88 teammates. Akeem was there as well. But now, on the Brother Love set, things start to go awry for Ted. I think maybe he should have conducted things a little bit more in private, and not so much publicly here, because it ended up backfiring on him.
When you're dealing with the thief, you go get the police! And I went out and I bought the best police protection that money can buy. That's right, I'd like to thank you, Slick, right here publicly for a job well done. You were very well paid, and the services were rendered, and you were very well paid. Now it's time to deliver.
Wait a minute. What's this about money? What's this about a payoff?
Wait a minute, brother. What you getting your danger ball up about? Now, I wouldn't call it a payoff. Let's just say Mr. DiBiase has given us a small token of his esteem. Let's just say a little donation.
I'm scratching my head a little bit here because Jake did, in fact, steal the $1 million belt. And the Big Boss Man went and got it back for Ted. But now he's taking offense at either doing mercenary work, which is quite rich considering that when the Big Boss Man comes back to the WWF in 1998, he is effectively a mercenary, like the same way he's being used here. Or is it the finder's fee being given to Slick? I'm a little bit unclear because in the kayfabe world, a percentage of the earnings of the wrestler goes to the manager. So you'd think that he'd be okay with that in some way. But I think it comes down to Slick. He should have used a different word, a token of his esteem. He should have used the word honorarium, like Dean Wormer in Animal House.
Well, I'm sure I can arrange a nice little honorarium from the student fund.
I like the word honorarium. It's very clean and classy. So maybe Slick should have gone in that direction. But the Boss Man is being accused now, DiBiase, of being scared. And the Big Boss Man's reaction to it is actually rather humorous because he just kind of blows it off and immediately shows that he's not scared.
Donation! It doesn't sound like a donation to me. You told me I was going to go out and retrieve stolen property. You didn't say nothing about no payoff.
Wait a minute. What's going on here, Slick? Let me tell you something. I bought and paid for your services. Now it's time to deliver. Boss Man! You have been paid. Now it's time to deliver the goods. So stick your hand in the bag and pull out my belt and give it to me.
Wait a minute, you fat face punk. Nobody tells the Big Boss Man what to do.
Let me tell you something, Boss Man. It's not the money, because any man with any brains would not refuse the kind of money I've given you. What it is you're just plain scared. You're just afraid to stick your hand in that bag and get my belt. So if you're scared, just say scared.
Look at my eyes, boy. Do I look like a man that's scared of anything? Well, let me tell you something. I'm not scared of any beast, man or life, and I especially ain't scared of you. I tell you what, boy. I'm going to show you what scared is. I'm going to show you what afraid.
What's he done? He's going in the bag. Big Boss Man is going in the bag. He has the million.
This is what your money bought and paid for. Well, if you want it, you're going to have to get it the old-fashioned way. You're going to have to earn it.
What? Slick, what's he doing? What's
he doing?
He just reaches in the bag, shows him the belt, and then stuffs it back in. And it's a little bit clumsy in terms of getting there, because he's very concerned about Slick getting some sort of payoff, which I don't get why he would be offended by that. I think it's just a moment of conscience by the Big Boss Man saying, I don't want to be a protector for some a-hole rich guy who just wants his stupid little toy back. I mean, that's basically what it was. And as we get a little bit further along, Boss Man's motivations are more easily explained, and it ends up being an extremely well-done angle, especially when you get to the next part. They needed, like, one of those ring carts to save them a little time going back and forth between the ring and the Brother Love set, because the Boss Man heads back to the ring with the key to the handcuff, because this whole time, Jake is handcuffed to the ropes, and he can't get out of there. He just kind of has to watch this. So Boss Man, he just offers him the key, but Jake, being a guy who always has psychology in mind, he's very skeptical, because here's this dude who just hit him in the back of the neck with a nightstick. No more than 5 minutes before this point. I can imagine Boss Man being like, oh, sorry about hitting you in the back of the head with the nightstick. And the other thing about this angle, I don't want to call it flawed, but Virgil is just standing there the entire time. Now, I will grant you that they had built up that Virgil was afraid of snakes this entire time, which is why DiBiase had to go out and get the Boss Man. But, yeah, Virgil kind of useless at this point in time. You know, almost like, why did you even bother keeping him employed? Now the Boss Man heads back to the Brother Love set. No wonder why Boss Man lost all that weight. He's just traveling back and forth between sets nonstop. And he kind of shoves Slick, which, and now we've firmly established that Boss Man is on the side of good, truly on the side of law and order, which would be the term that he would use for years to come. It was a great way and time to turn the Boss Man, although a little bit awkward for those in the live audience, because this was taped prior to the Royal Rumble, so anybody watching this who's at this taping might have been a little bit confused when the Royal Rumble shows up about 2.5 weeks later, and he's fighting the big Boss Man is fighting Hacksaw Jim Duggan and loses via disqualification, is how I think that turned out. Although the point is, maybe I shouldn't drill down so far and think about all these things, like why the big Boss Man would be afraid of Pat. It's just because he's a noble man deep down. That is why he's refusing this payoff. He stands for law and order, even though Jake did steal the belt, which I'm still a little bit confused about. But I think you can explain that. But he doesn't want to do the bidding of asshole rich guys, which, by the way, is as good of an excuse as any to not vote for Mike Bloomberg. I don't want to get political or anything, but I'm not going to endorse any candidates at this point, but I'm going to do the anti-endorsement of Mike Bloomberg, because if you don't like one asshole billionaire from New York, I don't think having a different asshole billionaire from New York is going to solve anything. Anyway, this angle was really great. And to top it all off, you know, to answer any questions you might have about his motivations and what's going on, we have the big Boss Man on hand. They're going to give him 60 seconds to clarify the situation.
Slick, your first mistake was questioning the honor and integrity of the big Boss Man. You don't question the uniform. You don't question the name of the big Boss Man and what I stand for. Second mistake, boy, was you lied to me. You lied to me about property that belonged to Jake the Snake Roberts. Well, let me tell you something, punk. You can't make a thief out of me. You can't buy me. Just because DiBiase had money don't mean that you can buy the big Boss Man. You understand me, boy? DiBiase, let me get something straight to you, boy. How does it feel to find a man that you can't buy, that you can't own? Well, you're looking at him, standing tall, standing proud in the name of the law. Let me warn you, boy, the lifeblood that flows through your body that makes you the million-dollar man sheds just like any other man. Makes you just like any other man. And let me tell you something, punk. These cuffs were made for you. They're custom made, and you'll wear them if you step out of line with a big buck.
A lot of talk about the big Boss Man from this time goes into how good he was in the ring for somebody of his size, and how he shed a lot of weight late 1990 and into 1991. But should not go unsaid, as a promo from the moment he gets there in 88, where granted Slick is there, he's doing most of the talking, but Boss Man would do kind of these angry, really intense promos in like short bursts. But when he becomes a babyface and he's standing for law, order, and justice, also an excellent promo. I don't want to say he's maybe the most underrated guy in WWF history, but from this golden era, I think historically he might be a little bit overlooked in terms of his ability on the stick. Hold on tight, tonight. Roxette with one of their big hits from the early 90s, Dangerous. Of course, they were in the news early this week. Marie Fredriksson, the singer of Roxette, passed away after a lengthy battle with cancer. I think maybe I should revisit some of their catalog. I hear it on Sirius XM some of the times, and I know the songs That, The Look, Joyride, but they never really registered with me too much, but I instantly recognize them when they come on the radio. Now, Dangerous would be a way to just describe the Colossal Collection. More on that. Colossal. Did I call them the Colossal Collection? They're a Colossal Connection. God. Well, at least not the Colostomy Connection, like the Mean Gene said at WrestleMania 6. They are taking on the team of Jim Gorman and Rico Federico, and I've been waiting to do this match for a very long time because, well, one of my friends, his last name is Federico, although he doesn't really hang out with us too much anymore, even though he lives in the city where I now work. And Jim Gorman is the name of one of my dear friends. And I've talked about this in the past. And he couldn't be any less of a professional wrestler, I think. I think he'd be a pretty bad promo, a little bit long-winded and kind of like Backlund circa 1981, where it's just like a little too serious. I mean, he's a computer programmer and all, but think of him, if he became a pro wrestler, it'd be like if Rich Eisen decided to become a pro wrestler, because it's pretty much his celebrity doppelganger. The one thing I have against him is he snitch tagged me to that Cold Takes Exposed Twitter last year during Game 7 of the Boston-Toronto series, because I had said like 4 days earlier something like, I'd like to complain about what Marcus Johansson does on the Bruins, but then I remembered he doesn't do anything. Of course, he had been pointless in the series when I wrote that, but he snitch tags me after he scores in Game 7. So I basically excommunicated him for a day or two because I was very displeased with that. Snitch tagging, just don't do it unless you're going to snitch report somebody on Twitter, which I wholly endorse because Twitter is a friggin' cesspool. So the Colossals, they are the tag champs as a stand-in for the Brainbusters, because it just seemed very, very sudden that the Brainbusters lose the title at the beginning of October is when it's taped. It airs the beginning of November. They work out their notice, get the whole Arnatale thing, but that's for another time. But all of a sudden, the Demolition, they lose the tag titles after about 6 weeks to the Colossal Connection, Haku and Andre the Giant. It's a nice little last hurrah for Andre, as it turned out. Yes, he did have a handful of matches after WrestleMania 6, including even one in the WWF in Europe in 1991. But, I mean, that was pretty much it for him on any sort of stage. And with Haku, I mean, Andre and Haku might be the all-time do-not-F-with-these-guys teams. And I was thinking through wrestling history, now, this would be the greatest real-world tag league of all time, where you take Andre and Haku and you put them in there with other teams that, like, you wouldn't want to mess with in a real-life context. I think the Crusher and Dick the Bruiser, I think those two guys might stand well in that term. One WCW. I think Rick Rude and Manny Fernandez, that'd be a pretty tough team if you were to meet them in a dark alley somewhere. Like, the bar fight champions of all time. And I would put Murdoch with Slater because, I don't know, while I love that bar fight scene with Murdoch and Dusty from The Wrestler, I just can't take Dusty seriously as a barroom brawler. Dick Slater, there would be no such problems. I mean, for God's sakes, he swirlied Sting. I mean, let's think about that for a second. So the way this team is made up is sort of like a baseball, sort of like how you'd want a baseball game to go if you're a manager in like the 1980s. Things are different now, but Haku, he's the starting pitcher. He's going to come in, and you want him to go 7 innings, maybe 8 innings if everything goes well, and then Andre comes out of the bullpen and gets the final 3 outs. I've called Andre the Giant the closer on many occasions, but that is how they work these matches, with Haku doing all the work, and then Andre would come in and get the final 3 outs. So, of course, we start with Gorman and Haku just lays in some martial arts, including that noted martial art move, the inverted atomic drop. But Gorman is able to get a shot to the body, and he tags out. And Federico does a little bit of work, but unfortunately, things move to the other side of the ring. And Andre gets in there and hits a headbutt, and he holds he tags Haku, who comes into the ring, and he holds Federico, who gets the big super kick from Haku. And then Andre, even though he's not the legal man, drops one of those careful elbows where he's kind of holding on to the ropes, and then he just kind of lays there for the 1-2-3, even though Andre's not the legal man. But I think it's a situation where, are you going to tell Andre the Giant that he's not the legal man in the ring? He literally cannot be moved, either by himself or by anybody else. So this was what it was in terms of, you know, the Brainbusters were probably going to hold the tag titles until WrestleMania 6 if they didn't leave. But failing that, giving Andre this nice little send-off is certainly a good thing.
You know, I could sing the praises all day about my colossal connection. And Demolition, nobody knows better than you how tough the colossal connection is.
And you want to find a tough foe we got? You find it. Come in that ring and fight that man, because you don't look like a man to us anymore.
What can I say? The cement truck is right in front of us, Bobby. Hit it. The family are staying. The Andre the Giant will give it.
I don't think I'm 100% on what Andre actually said. I mean, that was pretty incoherent. I think it was, come in the ring, fight us like a man, because you don't look like a man. Something like that. Actually, I should check something.
Oh, I'm in the service. Never got more runners like you. Never got the Afna. Yeah, it was that number. Ha, ha, ha. Never got free.
And just doing my due diligence, checking to see if there are any satanic messages backmasked in that Andre promo, or if he's telling us that Paul McCartney is dead. Haku definitely knows the importance of family as well. Whenever Haku smiles, it makes me smile. I don't know what it is about him. He's just really a big teddy bear, after all. And our final promo for the Cap Center show, and by the way, I should mention that Andre did not wrestle on that show, because they had done a matinee in Charlotte earlier in the day. They go up to Washington, and it's my theory that Andre said, you know what, screw this. I'm not doing two matches in one day, even if I'm just going to stand on the apron. It's kind of like they don't use the closer generally for both ends of the doubleheader. He's like, all right, I pitched the ninth in the early game. I'm not coming back out for the other one. So Jake the Snake Roberts and the Ultimate Warrior are on one side of the main event against the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and Akeem. So seeing Jake and the Warrior together for this promo, where the Warrior is, I've said, is in like my least favorite Ultimate Warrior era for, in terms of his promos, and you got Jake holding the Million Dollar Belt because he's holding possession of that away from Ted. Seeing this is so hilarious given what happens just a short year and a half later.
Oh, I do like it when it starts to turn to the left. I mean, you look at the WWF lately. A lot of strange things happening. I mean, some instances and things really got pretty weird. But that's all right with the Snake, because you see, the Snake is always like the things that rode the rough edge. Like a silent night cutting through the WWF. Things are happening. The Boss Man. A changed man, no. Just a man, able to stand on his own 2 feet. Just like us. That's what makes us different, DiBiase. We don't live a lie. You live in a lie, we got a special referee. That's something you both got to deal with. I don't think you can.
You have to deal with the differences! And that all we smell is victory as you breathe in defeat!
When Jake referenced the Boss Man there, I don't pay any attention to what Warrior says, but when Jake is talking about the Boss Man, it just occurred to me, hey, it's just two guys from the suburban Atlanta area. I mean, they could bond over that. I mean, Stone Mountain is to the east of Atlanta and Cobb County is to the north, but you feel like that those two guys would have more in common and that they get along pretty well, just kind of a natural alliance, and you could have the two of them team up in WrestleFest at the arcade if you want. Only a few short months until I can go back to Salisbury Beach to that second floor where I only found out that there was a WrestleFest machine on my last visit there over the summer. And that's it for this edition of Wrestling Challenge. They tell us that next week the feature bout will be Dusty Rhodes against Rick Martel, which is pretty good. But also on the show is Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Dino Bravo, and the Powers of Pain. That's going to be pretty much near the end for the old Powers. But that's it for Wrestling Challenge for February 11th, 1990. Yeah. another podcast this week. Be on the lookout for a new sportscasters with Steve Bennett, although I still can't get over the last one with Jimmy Traina for the interview where they're talking about the Howard Stern show, and Steve just kept bringing up the point. And it's now drilled and embedded in my brain that the Howard Stern show has 72 employees for 112 shows a year. I'm never going to forget that for as long as I live, or at least until Howard reduces it to like 105 shows or whatever in the next contract. So anyway, in other podcasts, on the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they're looking at USWA action from 1993. That's one that I've always wanted to get to, especially one of the ones where Vince makes an appearance on there and does the promo, like the one where he's wearing the USWA belt. Like, that whole thing fascinates me. Of course, I could probably just do a special on that 30-part Memphis playlist, excuse me, Mick Memphis playlist that's out there about all about Vince McMahon and his dealings in there. But that would actually last longer than a full show. It's probably a two-hour stretch of videos. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Fury, Brian Malonis is out this week as he's still moving into his house, and there's an intervention staged by Brian Fury with Mike Crockett about how he doesn't want to watch any modern wrestling, which, I don't know, I was kind of rooting for Mike to hold his ground there because I think I could poke a few holes into Brian Fury's argument, but I think the real thing that Brian Fury, the owner of Chaotic Wrestling, say is, yes, the modern product is actually really good, so come on down to Chaotic Wrestling this Friday night at the Elks Club in Hudson, Massachusetts. And if that doesn't sell you on it, it's less than a 15-minute walk from Medusa Brewing Company, one of the best breweries in all of, well, I don't want to, it's not quite Eastern Massachusetts, but I guess it's Central Massachusetts. I don't know, but hey, you know, that's enough of a draw for me. Of course, I can't really drink at this point because of my recent heartburn. But I'll tell you what I can do is I can make football picks. I've been on fire the last couple weeks. It's time for Vinny Vegas Corner. Yes, I've been on a bit of a hot streak, 5-0-1 the last 2 weeks, and 2-0-1 last week. Thanks a lot, Tampa Bay, for coming back in that game and only beating Indianapolis by 3. That's the first push of the year, 23-18-1. So kind of looking around, really nail it down, but I'm going to start in Kansas City. I'm going to ride that wave again of picking against the team that played the Patriots the week before, not because I'm vengeful or vindictive or any of that, but because there's an established history of teams having a letdown game after they play the Patriots. Kansas City picking up a win in Foxborough is impressive on its face. Of course, when you drill down, the officiating in that game left a lot to be desired, as Gorilla Monsoon would say. They're favored by 10 over the Denver Broncos this week, and Denver was like one of my best picks of the year last week against Houston. The same circumstances with Houston coming off a win against the Patriots. They're blowing them out at one point, 38-3, and ends up 38-24 after a bunch of garbage time, but they were underdogs of 9.5 points in that game, starting apparently the future of the National Football League, Drew Locke, at quarterback. I was very impressed with his poise down there, and now they're in Kansas City, they're underdogs by 10, and I'm going to take the damn points, and I'm going to bank on a letdown by the Kansas City Chiefs in this one, and that I'll get a little something out of Drew Locke. So I'm going to stay in the AFC West and go out to Oakland. Jacksonville at Oakland. Boy, this is a game for the ages. This is one of those Mad Dog Russo ones where him and Mike Francesa are picking it back in the day. Mike, if this game was being played in my backyard, I'd draw the blinds. I wouldn't watch. But it is the last game in Oakland, for real. Apparently, this move to Vegas is going to happen. I feel like we heard about it in like 1999, and it's only happening now with the new Vegas stadium apparently going to open next year. Jacksonville has not impressed me at all since they got to about, I think they were at 4-4 at one point. They've so bad that now Gardner Minshew is back in there. By the way, never seen Gardner Minshew and Anthony Green in the same place at the same time. I think that they are the same person. Oakland favored by 6.5. There's a lot of points to lay for the, how that team has played recently, but I think they'll bring it for the last game in Oakland. So I'll take the Raiders minus 6.5. And for a third game, boy, I'm really going bottom of the barrel here. Who gives a crap about the Miami Dolphins at the New York Giants? Hey, Eli Manning played on Monday Night Football this past week, and now he's one game under 500 for his career. So we salute you, Eli. Hell of a career you've had. And the Giants are actually favored by 3.5 points, which is just insane. So I'm going to take the points in the ultra-entertaining Miami Dolphins at 3.5. Because do you see Brian Flores coming off the field after the loss against the Jets? He was really pissed off about something. I don't know what it was, but I'm going to put my money behind a guy, well, my imaginary money, behind a coach who's that fired up despite being the coach of a 3-10 team. So to recap, Dolphins getting 3.5. in the Meadowlands against the Giants, Denver getting 10 at Kansas City, and Oakland giving 6.5 at home against Jacksonville for Vinny Vegas Corner. Now for next week's show, I don't know what that's going to be because a lot of new stuff is coming onto YouTube, and I get very excited about it. I have one show planned for if a certain event in politics happens. So that might be coming down the pike soon. The Mid-Atlantic show from February of 1983, that will be in 2 weeks on the 26th, so the day after Christmas, or Boxing Day for those lucky people in other countries that are not the United States throughout the world. I certainly envy you for that. And while I'm envying you and also Americans who will have that day off, even though I will not, I would ask you to please give a 5-star review on iTunes/Apple Music. It is definitely appreciated by me and also provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. I'm looking at my laptop right now, and I've been having all sorts of issues with Kaspersky. And there was one listener who wrote in and sent me a list of laptops that to look at that are good for podcasting. And I thank you for that. I've delayed my purchase of a new laptop until after Christmas. But yeah, I'm going to have to revisit that as every... I can see like the little waves on Audacity as it comes up. It's like flickering a little to the point where I'm afraid it's going to be like part one of that Royal Rumble show and it's going to cut off some of what I said. So without any further ado, I'm just going to call it right there. Thank you so much for listening again, and tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Out of Town.
Tony Giovanni, I'd put my money on a hitman.